Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at your pet's health. And Dr. Bill Stork back with us on the show today. He is the owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, and we want to talk with him about pets with fireworks anxiety, and we'll also take your other pet care questions as well. So, does your pet have problems with loud noises? Love to have you part of the conversation. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Bill Stork, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thanks, Larry. Good morning.
So, you know, I have a friend's dog that I take care of, Lila, and nothing seems to bother her. There can be loud noises, and she just sort of you wouldn't even know that she heard them. But then I have other friends who have pets that are just terrible when it comes to fireworks or other loud noises. Why is that the case? Is it a training issue? Is it how the dogs are wired?
Well, I think it can be multifactorial. It can be the way they are wired. It can be that they develop an association with those sounds. And I don't feel as if this is the entire issue, but of course, I think there's times when we inadvertently build that anxiety in them by the way we react to loud noises and sounds and things like that. And, you know, I can't be too critical because right now, back at my house north of Fort Atkinson, our neighbors are target shooting just over the hill, and my little 13-year-old Australian Shepherd Blue Heeler Cross is probably hunkered down in the closet under my wife's clothes because that's her safe spot when the neighbors are shooting or when fireworks go off. And it's interestingly, it's not universal, and this is not a scientific thing. This is just my own personal observation, is that I've known dogs that get really worried about thunderstorms, and even I've known dogs that get worried about rain on windows. But that same dog may not give a hoot if you're shooting off a cannon next door.
It's amazing. Well,
yeah, they don't all read the book.
So let's say I had a dog that has problems of this nature. What do we do to make things easier for our pet?
Well, rewinding a little bit, and at the risk of sounding like a one-trick pony, it seems like on this show I'm always talking about doing things that you can wear them out both physically and mentally. And, you know, we know that this weekend that people are going to be shooting off fireworks, and they don't even necessarily wait until dark to start doing it. In which case, way back at the beginning of the day, you work as hard as you can to wear them out. And if that means taking them for walks around the neighborhood, if that means taking them swimming, if that means feeding them chew toys, antlers, Kongs that have been frozen and filled with good stuff throughout the day leading up to the evening when the fireworks have a tendency to be concentrated, so that we're wearing their brains out and wearing their bodies out. And then, you know, when the fireworks get going, then the things that we recommend, there are dogs, and we'll hear about this, you know, they'll seek a spot in the basement, and they'll hide behind the toilet in the basement or under a bed. And if that's where they want to go, and when they get there, it becomes tolerable, then we make that place accessible for them and work as best we can not to overly react ourselves. Because one of the things that we know is that anxiety can be contagious. So the more we react, the more they will react. So let them seek their place of comfort. But this is also the time of the year where our phone is ringing off the hook, asking us, you know, can we give them anything for the anxiety? And there's a couple of different pharmaceuticals that we can use, one of which is a straight up sedative, and the other one is as close to a situational anti-anxiety medication as exists. And, you know, the popular request is, oh, give them something just to take the edge off. And, you know, that's a pretty narrow tightrope for us to try and walk, to just take the edge off of them so they're all hunky-dory with the rocket's red glare outside their window, but they're not completely and totally out of it. So it's hard to do without making them also a little bit sedate as well. But some of the things that people can help themselves and help their pets out with, and we know it's coming. And if we wait to go over and pull down the, say, trazodone, for example, until they start lighting the fuses, then it's too late. And once they've started to experience that stress, it's really hard to back them down. So what we recommend people to do, we know it's coming, to even start a day or so ahead of time if we're using pharmaceuticals, and even give them morning and evening leading up to the 4th of July.
What do you think about pressure wraps? Do they work, do you think?
I knew you were going to ask that. Things like thunder shirts and stuff like that, and kind of a product of our old friend Temple Grandin from way back in the day. And the answer is, for some, absolutely. It really does make a difference for some dogs. And, you know, could be a thunder shirt by brand, or it doesn't necessarily have to be. I mean, sometimes you can just buy them a tightly fitting garment, or like you said, you know, some people will wrap them with ACE bandages and stuff like that.
So it, I mean, it's probably worth a try.
Absolutely.
if you haven't done, okay. Are there other, you know, I was thinking about Patricia McConnell, who I've worked with a long time, and I'm trying to remember the behavioral methods that might work. In your mind, do they work with this anxiety, behavioral methods?
Well, you know, the things that we've talked about, you know, our attitude can feed into their attitude. That's a big one. Wearing them out is a big one. One of the things that Dr. McConnell, easy for me to say, Dr. McConnell, Patricia might also say, is she might talk about counter conditioning. And counter conditioning would be for us to try and reassign a new emotion to those loud noises. Well, that's a noble notion, but you have to start early, be patient, and it takes us a while. So for example, at the first note that they may be reacting to a loud noise, but they haven't escalated with rapid breathing and pacing and panting and stuff like that, you reward them in an effort to assign a new reaction to an old stimulus.
And that takes a bit of time, and it takes somebody
and
who's
patience.
Pretty good at judging their dog.
It certainly does, yeah.
Catching them the right way, at the right point, for sure. Dr. Bill Storick, our guest today, we're talking with him. Well, we started talking about fireworks and dogs, but we can take other questions as well. What about your pet's health or other questions? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to water for a minute. Lots of dog owners like to take their pets to water areas, and I know there can be some problems encountered when swimming.
You bet. And I am a big fan of dogs who want to get in the water. you know, I encourage them to swim as much as they possibly can. And with right here in Lake Mills being an example, we've got a beautiful 1,100-acre lake with pretty darn clear water. But some of the things to be aware of is just easy in and easy out, because there's only a few places here in Lake Mills where dogs can get in and out of the water without having to navigate some pretty big boulders. So a good place for them to get into and back out of the water is a big deal. I get questions every now and then about swimmer's itch. And can dogs be affected by swimmer's itch? And the short answer is, yes, they can. But swimmer's itch, whether it's people or our dogs, is more of a big, broad category of parasites than it is a very specific situation. And it's a pretty narrow window of time when either we or our dogs are eligible to be affected by it. And it's also as one of those many situations where common sense prevails. Swimmer's itch will be much more concentrated on the end of the lake that the wind is blowing to. So if you're on the opposite side of the lake, you're going to be much better off. And also, just like us, if when we get out of the water, if you rinse them off and dry them off, they're going to be affected much less. And once again, in all of the time that I've been here in practice, I've seen very few situations where I honestly think it was as a result of swimmer's itch, especially because there are so many other things that affects dogs' skin. The one thing associated with swimming that we see that is truly horrifying, that is fairly common. I mean, I will probably see a case or two this year of dogs that have been affected by blue-green algae. And yeah, once again, the whole blue-green algae is a bit of a gross generalization, because it doesn't have to be blue. It doesn't have to be green. It can be pink. It can't even be seen. And there's so many different variations and situations that can vary the concentration of those toxins in that water. The short answer is, don't let your dog in punky, standing, shallow, warm, gross water.
Yeah.
And not just for blue-green algae. There's other things as well that can be deleterious to their health.
Do you ever have cases where dogs get water in their ears? I get, every time I go swimming, I get water in my ears, and it drives me crazy. Sometimes I can't get it out.
Yeah, of course. And that's the perfect question. Here we are talking about blue-green algae and scary stuff like that. But labs and golden retrievers and all those breeds that love to swim so much, ears that stay wet after they go swimming can eventually lead to either discomfort or ear infections. And to keep 4x4 cotton swabs on hand and or Q-tips on hand that you can dry those ears out can be quite beneficial. And oftentimes people are programmed to be cautious with regard to Q-tips in dogs' ears. And the truth of the matter is, the things that we like to avoid are, we don't like to stuff things down in there. If there is debris, you want to make sure you're dragging it out as compared to pushing it in. And as far as damaging the eardrum or anything like that, if you keep that swab vertical compared to the dog's head, you can never come anywhere close to their eardrum or do damage.
Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today, as we take a look at your pet's health. Lee Rayburn's our engineer, by the way, and Jill Nadeau's our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with Dr. Bill Stork. He is the owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him with us to talk about your pet's health. And lots of callers online, Bill. So let's go to the phones. Eric and Madison, we'll go to you first. Thank you for calling.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Real quick, we've got a new puppy that we got from the Humane Society. She's 9 months old, and they said she was a bulldog mix. So she's super sweet and doing really well with maturing and training. But she's real mouthy, and she leads all the time with a little bit of a sort of a hop and a hiss, if you will. And I don't know if it's a bulldog trait or if it's just her little, her way of doing things. But I wonder, this, you know, we've tried doing things like giving her a bone, giving her a chew, and she does well with it. She's not destructive. She's not a really crazy chewer. She just has this little mouthy sort of lead to her, and I wondered if you had any thoughts on how we may be able to kind of curb her away from that.
All right, when you say mouthy, Eric, is she kind of like mouthing on your arm or leg?
Yep,
or?
Yep. She'll walk next to you or behind you, and she'll kind of hop a little bit and kind of give you not a nip, but she's just mouthy. You know, it's not from aggression. It really feels affectionate, playful, but she doesn't bite hard. She's not breaking the skin at all. It's just, she's just a little mouthy, licky kind of thing. So I wondered if you had any thoughts.
Okay.
Well, my first thought, Eric, is that I can tell by your demeanor. I love the fact that you're paying attention to this now, when it's not anything that resembles aggressive. And I also get the impression that you're not reprimanding or scolding her or anything like that. And the fact that you're looking to put appropriate things in her mouth instead of putting inappropriate things in her mouth. So nicely done on several levels. And there again, giving her something to chew on is the perfect approach to the situation. Another approach that will have people do, you know, what do we do with kids, is we ask them to do what we want them to do when we feel they're in danger of doing what we want them not to do, like mouthing on things. So for example, if she's got a good sit or another command that she will obey in a situation like that, you can stop her and ask her to do the things that you want her to do when she's in the process of doing what you want her not to do. And then I suspect she probably does this around the house as well. And one of the things that we'll do, like with those puppies that go into piranha mode where they're chomp, chomp, chomping on everything, is we just walk away. And whatever it is that we're chomping on, whatever body part, an arm or whatever the case may be, we either stop and freeze. We call it freeze tag. Or at 9 months of age, she may or may not be amenable to a crate. If she's amenable to a crate, you look for that teaching moment when she's chomping and mouthing on your hand, and you put her in the crate and shut the door. Or you walk out of the room and shut the door. And you look for an opportunity to create a very distinct association with that behavior. And then you just redirect, distract, freeze, or remove her from the situation.
Yeah. All good tips, I believe. Eric, thank you for calling. Carol in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi, good morning or afternoon. I don't know which. I am interested in trying to figure out what the best means of curbing barking is. I have an 18-month-old mini golden doodle. She's a little more poodle than golden, but I don't know how to get her to stop barking. She'll see somebody walk by, you know, she's in the house, she's looking out the front window, she'll bark at dogs, she'll hear errant noises and bark her head off. When people come towards her that she doesn't know, she barks her head off, but she never is aggressive with, like, anyone she meets. She just barks her head off, but it sounds like, geez, you know, she's going to bite me. So
yeah.
I just, you know, I've heard of, like, rattling coins in a can, but, you know, I don't have that to whip out when we're on a walk. Or I've tried coins in a coin purse, but it's tough to catch her that. And I've also bought recently some of the, like, it's like a little spray pump and it makes a hiss, but I don't believe in putting, like, any sort of shocking collar on her. I just don't know how to get her to stop barking. When she was small, like 6-8 months, we went to basic manners class. All the other puppies were quiet, except she was barking her head off, and I could hardly hear what the teacher was saying.
Hmm.
Yeah, boy, Carol, you've got a really difficult challenge ahead of you. And at 18 months of age, you have a lot to undo there. And first of all, thank you for not considering using a shock collar or anything to that effect. Second of all, if you've managed so far not to yell at her or tell her to be quiet or anything like that, you're probably a little bit stronger than I am, because it's really maddening in situations like this when you have dogs that essentially bark at air to not get frustrated yourself and escalate the problem. That just makes you human. So everything that we've talked about in this show and others beforehand come into play in this situation. And you may even have to employ the services of a professional reward-based trainer to get you through this situation. But we were talking earlier about dogs that are nervous about fireworks. We take that dog out, and anything we can do to drain mental and physical energy off of them, taking them for walks, giving, you know, feeding her from a puzzle bowl, to make her work for her food, giving her stuffed Kongs to once again work on that brain, because you just talked about a dog that's energetic, active, and brilliant. So you have a lot of mental energy to try and displace. Then the nuts and bolts of deprogramming a dog that barks at everything is that you have to try and identify what it is that she's about to bark at before she does. Get her to do something that you want her to do, and then reward her for not barking. If she starts barking, you lost that round. Another thing that you can possibly do, and we had a set of clients once upon a time, they had small kids that they could volunteer, and we could bait them. We could create a situation where we knew there was going to be stimulation for that dog to bark. So we'd have the kids walk by the house. Owner would have the dog on the leash in the house. As soon as that dog started to bark, they very calmly walked her away, put her in a crate, walked her away, put her in a door. Those are some of the tools that you can use actively. Otherwise, we've had clients who have had to get pretty drastic about literally, you know, getting heavy duty shades to cover up their windows, to buy them a little bit of sanity while they're working actively on different approaches to the situation. But it can be done to reprogram this dog. It will be a challenge. It will be an all-in multifactorial approach to the situation.
Good luck, Carol. Thank you so much. It sounds like, you know, a positive reinforcement trainer might be a good start to get her on the right track. I'm the Bill.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This one's not going to be easy.
Thank you again. Let's go to Pat in Wauwatosa. Hi, Pat.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Hi, Dr. Bill. I have a dog, 6.5 years old. I don't know what he is. He's a rescue dog. Great dog. We've had him for 5 years. And he started limping, and I took him to the doctor, to the vet, and they did an MRI and found that he has a 100% torn ACL on the right back leg.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not in pain with it at all. But his limitations are jumping into my car. He used to just scoot right up there. Now I sort of have to help him up there. Or he walks on three legs on the stairs, and that's the only limitation I see. The doctor said he could do a surgical repair for about $3,000. And I said, well, okay. Well, what are the other options? And he said, well, to see how it goes. And I'm wondering if I'm doing the right thing, just seeing how it goes. I don't know if ACLs repair themselves at all. And then I've heard that if you get that surgery, the other one goes off. And so I'm just getting your advice about a torn ACL. And as I said, he's not in pain. If he was suffering a lot, I'd get it right away. He's a great active dog, but he's just a little limited by this.
Sure. Well, in order to answer that question, and you've touched, Pat, on something that's kind of an overarching issue that we hear a fair bit, and I'm going to inflict the Vernon Strasburg story on this situation. And Vernon Strasburg was one of my favorite old German dairy clients. And I would go to that farm, and Vernon would milk cows, and he would climb out of the barn. And he'd walk across the yard, and he would lean up against the skid loader. And then he'd walk a few more feet, and he would lean up against the hay rack. Then he'd walk a few more feet, and he'd lean up against the machine shed. And finally, he'd climb on the tractor, and he would go feed cows. Then Vernon Strasburg went to the hospital and got his hip replaced, and he walked out of the barn, across the yard, climbed on the tractor, and fed cows. The point being that that stubborn old German dairy farmer that I loved the heck out of, not once did he say, man, my hip hurts. But the fact that he had to take all those breaks and lean up against all that equipment told me everything I need to know. And so it goes, you know, dogs don't necessarily verbalize, boy, my right rear leg hurts, but I've had that injury. And I can tell you from experience, it, articular cartilage is one of the most highly innervated tissues in the body. And although he may not be vocalizing, he may not be crying out, but for a 6-year-old dog to no longer be able to get in and out of your vehicle, and when he's picking that leg up and when he is unweighting that leg, he's telling you his leg hurts. And so with regard to the surgical repair, you know, what it is that they told you, that it's completely torn, it's not going to fix itself. And especially in a 50 or a 60-year-old dog, it's going to, what's going to happen in that knee is you're going to continue to accumulate more arthritic change, and repair will be less beneficial. And what they tell you is absolutely the case. If they tear one, they have at least a 50% chance of tearing the other knee. And I've known a number of dogs, including my own, that's at home in the closet underneath the, she waited until she was 12 or 13 years old to tear her ACLs. And he's going to be limited for the rest of his life unless you seek repair for that knee, for that ACL.
There you go, Pat. Something to think about. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Linda in Washburn, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call, Larry and Dr. Bill.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, I've got a golden retriever that just turned 7 years old, and back on May 21st, she was got where she was throwing up water. We took her in, and we ended up having major liver issues. Dr. Bill, you'd probably be familiar, but her ALT on May 23rd was 1,799.
Oh boy!
And from my understanding, normal is more around 130.
Yep.
So, and associated other numbers were very high. And she's been on major medications, amoxiclav, doxycycline. They checked her for lepto. It wasn't lepto. The vet has no idea what caused it. Her numbers are down. She's a strong young dog, and her numbers, her last test on her numbers on her ALT was down to 213. So she responded to treatment. Our biggest issue was the diet, because she was on so much antibiotic. She's been on a Serenia and a lot of other anti-vomit and poor appetite medication, and we're still working on trying to get appetite back. But anyway, my question is, have you heard of other dogs and other liver issues of this nature? And I guess my biggest concern is I'm worried about what it was, and is this going to come back? And I know you can't say without seeing the dog, but have you heard of anything of this nature?
Yeah, we certainly have. And, you know, the things that your veterinarian did up there in Washburn is the things that we always do is we try and go after the most common things that can make a liver mad like that. And on the list of things are infectious things like lepto is a very common culprit in situations like this. Dietary indiscretion, toxins, and sometimes we just don't know. And then as veterinarians, the position we find ourselves in is that, okay, we can continue to pursue an absolute diagnosis and by doing ultrasounds. You know, the ultimate diagnostic would be an ultrasound-guided biopsy of the liver. But frequently, that doesn't change the tools that we have available to us to treat that liver and to treat that dog. So we go after it with all the things that you mentioned, the antiemetics, the antibiotics, the fluids, all the supportive therapies. And it's a little bit unsatisfying in the sense that we don't know where it came from and we're forever living in fear of it coming back. But it goes down that way sometimes. And you may want to ask your veterinarian, once you get in the clear and an ALT of 213 is really, really good news because we have some wiggle room with regard to liver values. There are some measures that you can take to support the liver in general, kind of for a lifetime type situation.
Linda, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve in Stoughton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, and thank you. I have a Mastiff with relatively short fur, and the flies and other flying insects are just horrible this spring. And so my question, I've been looking at natural topical sprays or even shampoos to use, and I came across some with neem oil, N-E-E-M, and I was wondering what the doctor thinks about neem oil as a potential repellent.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to plead the fifth when it comes to that particular product. And of course, we know lots of people, if not everyone, who would really love to be able to repel insects and bugs and things like that around our pets using less chemical modalities. But seldom have they been as successful as we would like them to be. I had an associate here at our clinic once upon a time who really, really worked hard to try and use things as natural as she possibly could on her pets, and eventually had to throw up the white flag and resort to, there's a topical flea and tick prevention out there called Vectra that we've had for quite a while. And it's known to be a very safe product, and it is known to be the product that is most likely to repel things. And it's also really stout protection against fleas and ticks. And if those things aren't effective, you know, other things that people have used have been citronella. On our horses, my wife will use Listerine on our horses in an attempt to repel the mosquitoes and the flies. And, you know, if it doesn't repel the flies and the mosquitoes, it at least makes them smell pretty medicinal. So you may give that a try as well.
There you go, Steve. Thanks so much for calling. As I recall, neem oil is mostly used as a way to kill insects, and you have to spray it on the insect itself. But anyway, you might want to take another look at that too, Steve, because I don't think it works as a repellent so much either, at least as it relates to plants. I know that for sure.
We'll defer to Larry's 50 years of experience for that one.
Josh in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Josh.
Hello. I just have a question. I have two dogs that I got from the Humane Society. They're brothers. They're 4 years old, and one constantly has seizures. And I've yet to narrow it down to what it might be caused by. They did a DNA test, and they didn't have any. He didn't have any medical issues.
When you say that your dog continually has seizures, how frequently and how long do they last? And what does your dog do when it seizures?
He always dry heaves first, and then he'll puke up a yellow liquid or a white liquid, and then that's usually when the seizure will happen. It's under 5 minutes. And how often, it honestly depends, I guess. I'm pretty sure it's something that he's eating. Like I talked to an arborist. I think it has something to do with some wood chips that he likes to eat, but I still haven't narrowed it down.
Okay. Well, if we're talking, and I'm going to make a bit of an assumption here, that we're talking about a full-on seizure that lasts under 5 minutes, wherein the dog loses consciousness and, you know, possibly lays on its side, rigid paralysis, shaking. Sometimes they'll even lose control of their bowels and their bladder. And especially if this is something that's been going on for a fair bit of time, while it's tempting to blame that on something that he's eating, it's probably a seizure disorder. By definition, a seizure disorder. And we always try, either by testing or by collecting a history, to determine what it is that causes a seizure. More times than not, in repeat seizures, the cause is seizure disorder. You know, think in terms of epilepsy in people. And what I recommend that our clients do in a situation like that is a handful of things. One of which is write it down in your phone. If you're old school and you want to write it on your calendar, write it down. We always ask people, well, how long does it seem to last? Well, the answer is it seems to last for about 3 hours, because it's an eternity when our dog is seizuring and it's tough to watch. But time, how long it actually does last, that can be very meaningful. And then the other thing that can be very meaningful to your veterinarian is if you can get out your phone and take a video of it, that can be most excellent information and give us an idea as to where it is this can be coming from. And if we're ruled out everything else and we can't find the exact cause of the seizure, then we launch into an area that I call therapeutic diagnostics, meaning we treat the dog with anti-seizure medications and see if we can reduce the frequency, the duration, and the impact of the seizures.
Josh, thank you very much for calling, and good luck with your dog. Dr. Bill Stark, our guest, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Dr. Bill, we had an email from Martha to ask you to address dogs in summer heat. Specifically, how difficult is it for bronchocephalic dogs like bulldogs, boxers, Boston Terriers to cool themselves? Her boxer starts panting when it's 60 degrees out, can't tolerate heat at all. It's heartbreaking to see people out jogging with their dogs on a summer day. It's not just about giving them extra water, as they can't cool because of their short nasal passages.
Yeah, and it's particularly difficult for brachycephalic dogs, in particular because those guys are breathing through drinking straws, anatomically speaking, under the best of circumstances. So, You know, once again, this is a situation where ambient temperature, sunlight, and humidity makes a big difference, because the primary mechanism by which dogs thermoregulate is they exhale air that is 101.5 degrees and 100% humid. They inhale air that is hopefully cooler and less humid, and they radiate heat across that gradient. If it is 100% humid and really warm outside, then it becomes really, really difficult for them to cool. Then, of course, if they have dark coats, if they have heavy coats, then it becomes even more difficult. So, you know, lots of dogs love to have a nice, cool concrete basement floor or patio floor or something like that, that they can lose heat by contact in that fashion. Moving air can make a big difference, and simply budgeting time of the day when you subject them to activity can go a long way, because they just don't have a lot of ways to thermoregulate. And so we have to protect them from themselves.
Greg in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Thank you for calling, Greg. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Larry. Dr. Bill, I have two cats. They've grown up together as their siblings, as kittens. We've had them 2 years. One of them developed a what we believe to be a bladder infection. So we took it to the vet. It was gone about 2 hours when we reintroduced that cat to the household. The other sibling cat has not accepted it. It thinks it's another cat. The smell, apparently, when you do this type of thing, I think it's common, and it's only been about 3 days, but it will not accept. And they were best buddies. They played and everything. So it's so bizarre to me that a 2 hour time, two or 3 hour time frame. Now
I'm chuckling because I have the same problem with my own cats. That's why I take them both to the vet at the same time.
Yeah, well, that's a real consideration. And just from the archives, I had a very similar experience. We took a horse, a Clydesdale, to the veterinary hospital. And when we brought him back, the rest of the herd did not take kindly to his new smells. And you think it's an adventure having cats that don't accept one another. try that if the animals in question average 1,200 pounds apiece. So it's a real deal. So I think Larry's solution is excellent, which is if you need to take one to the clinic, take them both together, but it's a little too late for that now. But the recommendations that I will make, I'm just going to take a couple steps back and make recommendations that can work at large. And one of which is, even though you have two cats, if you can offer food and water in separate locations that are not visual between the two locations, that can help. If you're not already having multiple litter boxes in different locations that, once again, are not within visual distance of the other, that can make a difference. And one of the other things that can make a difference, and for an old guy like myself to be talking about pheromone therapy is a bit of a stretch, because to me, it seems like a little bit of hocus pocus medicine. But I have seen pheromone therapy genuinely work, and that exists in the form of products like Feel-Away, which is the facial pheromone that when a cat rubs up against your pant leg or your doorway or your walls, essentially they're saying, I've checked this out and it's okay. In which case, an active move that you could make to help yourself out in this situation would be to obtain a Feel-Away diffuser that I've seen it help. And my best blinded objective example of Feel-Away was, we had a client that had cats that were experiencing inter-cat aggression, and they used Feel-Away, called us back, follow-up telephone call, told us it was working beautifully. until 3 or 4 weeks later, he called us back and said, come up with another idea, wise guy, because the wheels have fallen off. And the reason why the wheels fell off is because his kid needed to charge his iPhone, so he unplugged the feel away.
Oh, man. Oh, thanks for that call. Appreciate it very much. Cindy in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I have a blue healer who was getting a lot of UTIs with crystals, but no actual, just crystals in her urine. But we changed her diet to Science Diet, sensitive skin, and sensitive stomach. But she still is getting it to where her vaginal area is so bad that she doesn't even hardly walk. She scoots because it's so itchy and so red. Then we do 2 weeks of antibiotics, and she's good. But why are we still getting it?
Well, buddy, once again, an issue that can have multiple causations, and you talked about one. There are dogs whose external genitalia is in such a fashion that it has a tendency to pool urine. For the sake of a family radio program, I call them innies and outies, in which case, if they have an infolding external genitalia, it can pool urine, and therefore it can perpetuate an infection. Then within the bladder, you know, we have a tendency to think about the bladder as just this vessel, but that vessel has lots of folds and rugae in which bacteria can harbor and they can sequester. And there's lots of factors having to do with the bacteria themselves that can make them inaccessible to antibiotics. There are some bacteria that have actually been found to colonize the walls of the bladder. So there's lots of diagnostics that can be done. The ultimate diagnostic is a urine culture. And oftentimes in these tenacious cases, we'll do a urine culture before and after the antibiotics to see if we need to continue to do them. And there are still other times we'll tolerate some degree of crystals in a dog's urine. And crystals are the ultimate case of which came first. Did the infection take place and as a result we have crystals, or were there crystals that were irritating to the bladder that perpetuated an infection? And if we get to the point that we feel that those crystals are truly part of the problem, there are yet other diets called dissolution diets that are formulated in such a fashion that they'll dilute and eliminate the crystals. So I'm with you. I just wrote a prescription for a dog that has its second urinary tract infection in 6 weeks. They can be tenacious and recurrent and challenging.
Cindy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dr. Bill, we have some special programming coming up, so your time is a little less today than it normally is, but I hope you'll be back and be with us again down the road. I really appreciate all of your great advice, Bill.
Yeah, well, I don't think I can compete with what's going on in Washington right now for pure entertainment value, if nothing else.
Dr. Bill Stork, our guest, the owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. He works with both small and large animals and does a great job. And he'll be back again. The U.S. House Committee is investigating the January 6th attack on our nation's capital, and it's holding its next public hearing today. And you can join us right now coming up for special coverage from NPR. The committee says this hearing will present recently obtained evidence, and it will include witness testimony. And so that's NPR's special coverage of the January 6th hearings today, starting at noon here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You could also go to WPR.org as well. Just a little tip about tomorrow's show. We'll be talking about paddling and biking tomorrow on the show at 11. And then at 11:45, we'll look at how to garden with kids. There's a new book out on that. I'm looking forward to reading that as well. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Thank you so much for listening, but please stay with us. Some important programming coming up next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.